and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I am Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, and whether he was chosen by the president as insurance in Trump's fight for self-preservation. Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on judicial nominations, joins us to discuss her article at the New York Times, "Will Kavanaugh Provide Cover for Trump?" We will assess how much Brett Kavanaugh's 2009 law review article, in which he advocated that Congress consider a law exempting a president from criminal prosecution, swayed Trump, and whether some kind of loyalty assurance was given that if and when the Supreme Court has to rule on a Mueller indictment or Trump's claim he can pardon himself and his underlings under investigation, Kavanaugh would rule to protect Trump. Then we'll discuss the future of workers' and consumers' rights in a 5-4 Supreme Court with a conservative majority in lockstep with the Republican agenda as it furthers the empowerment of corporations and the protection of corporate rights. Gigi Sohn, who served as a counselor to former FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler and is a distinguished fellow at Georgetown Law's Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy, joins us to discuss Kavanaugh's May 2017 dissent opposing net neutrality in favor of corporate First Amendment rights. We consider whether the most important question for Democrats to ask in the upcoming Senate confirmation hearings is if we want a Supreme Court stacked with corporatists who are opposed to workers and consumers. Then finally, we will look into the religious rights opposition to Kavanaugh's appointment, given Trump's slighting of Amy Barrett, the Catholic fundamentalist championed by Vice President Pence and Fox News' Sean Hannity. Sarah Posner, an expert on the intersection of religion and politics and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Value Voters, joins us to discuss her article at The Nation, "Will Brett Kavanaugh Pass the Religious Rights New Litmus Test?" We will assess what strategy the Democrats could pursue to make sure the Democratic senators who voted to confirm Gorsuch, Heitkamp, Manchin, and Donnelly will oppose Kavanaugh's appointment. And joining us now is Caroline Fredrickson, the president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director of NAREL Pro-Choice America. And she's the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. And she has an article at the New York Times, "Will Kavanaugh Provide Cover for Trump?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Caroline Fredrickson.
It's wonderful to be on the show.
Well, thank you, Caroline. And obviously, there's a major confirmation fight shaping up in the Senate. And frankly, it's pretty extraordinary to see the Majority Leader Mitch McConnell call for fairness after what he did with Merrick Garland. I guess, you know, I don't know what. You have to have a new definition of chutzpah, right?
That's right. I was just thinking of that, the old cliche about the person who killed his parents and is in front of a court and pleads for mercy, saying, "Hey, I'm an orphan." It's the same idea. You know, he wants fairness now. Now that there's a nominee put forward by Donald Trump, he certainly wasn't in favor of fairness for the nominee put forward by Barack Obama.
Well, I'd like to get into what you've written in your op-ed in the New York Times, Caroline Fredrickson, along, of course, with Norman Eisen, the chairman of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics crew. But just in general, to go back on the path that has led to this situation, which is the Federalist Society, and Leonard Leo has been given credit for having gotten Chief Justice Roberts on the court, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch, and now Brett Kavanaugh, if he's to be successfully voted on, which is a big question. But the Federalist Society itself, this idea that they're talking about strict constructionalism and originalism and all of that lofty stuff, but everything that they do is so much in keeping with the Republican agenda. Voter suppression.
Well, it's absolutely true. I think one of the one of the myths that the right and the Federalist Society particularly puts forth is that somehow originalism is a neutral theory. It's so neutral that somehow it only ever produces results that benefit the Republicans. You know, that's a neutrality I think Americans can live without. It sounds a lot more like extreme partisanship to me, and it's played out when you look at cases like Bush v. Gore and Citizens United and Shelby County, which is the case that destroyed the Voting Rights Act, which protected the voting rights of minorities in this country. It's a very outcome-driven theory, a theory that serves a very partisan agenda, but they cloak it with claims of neutrality. And it's back to the word you used earlier. It's chutzpah for absolute, absolutely surely.
And you have to add to that Citizens United opening the floodgates of unlimited political spending, and of course the hostility to women's reproductive freedom. That's all very manifest. And well, we know that Kavanaugh dissented in an opinion involving a young immigrant girl who was pregnant, who wanted an abortion, and he tried to prevent that. So there's no question he will overturn Roe v. Wade if he gets a chance. And of course the attack on public sector labor unions, which defunds the Democratic Party, which is clearly the motive of those behind it. So the list is pretty clear. So are we then to assume or conclude here that the Federalist Society is basically a group of conservative radicals funded by wealthy corporate and plutocratic interests? They're essentially...
you know, there's evidence for it. So you know, it's not just an assumption. It's actually all you have to do is look at their finances and look at what they have said and done and see how much in service of those plutocratic agenda items the organization has been. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, Donald Trump has basically listened to them. I mean, not just listened to them, but been dictated to them in terms of who his nominees have been, not just at the Supreme Court level, but all of the federal judges that he's nominated have come through the Federalist Society, are people who, you know, follow this agenda, this extreme right-wing agenda that's all about destroying unions, preventing women from exercising their constitutional rights to determine what they do with their bodies, destroying the right to vote, and empowering Republicans and plutocrats so that our democracy is really, I think, under extreme threat.
So he nevertheless, at the brief photo op when President Trump announced his nomination, he went out of his way to talk about feeding the homeless and how much he coaches young women like his own daughters in baseball, etc. So that was an obvious, perhaps even a crass attempt at suggesting that he's a compassionate person. But on the other hand, his rulings are clearly those of a corporatist, where he puts power over people. I mean, that's just fundamental. And by the way, in all of these hearings that we've had for all of these judicial nominees on the Supreme Court, nobody ever seems to ask that question, are you not a corporatist?
Well, you know, one of the things that has, you know, also been substantiated by hard data is the fact that corporations in America have never done as well as they have in the Roberts Court. So, you know, it's the whole Federalist Society pipeline. It's John Roberts. It's Sam Alito. They have been marching in this direction since they've been on the court. And Chief Justice Roberts has been extraordinarily significant in finding uniformly for corporations. You know, the Gorsuch is, you know, just another one in the line. And you know, if Kavanaugh gets confirmed, you know, the corporations in America are going to be pretty much unchecked. There's not going to be nearly the ability for all of us to be protected from pollution, from dangerous products, from employment discrimination or mistreatment, because corporations will be unleashed. And, you know, I think it's again, you know, something really people have to understand, that the courts are not just something that happens to somebody else. It's not just, you know, part of the government that only has an impact on somebody who's, you know, arrested for breaking the law. It's actually the courts are where all these really important decisions are made about whether the laws that we think were passed by our legislators, either Congress or in the State House, to protect us, that we supported, that we elected them to do, are now being struck down as unconstitutional because these judges and justices think that corporations should always win.
And again, I'm speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director of NARAL Pro-Choice America. And she is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. And she has an article at the New York Times, Will Kavanaugh Provide Cover for Trump? Well, just to finish up, my sense is that the Democrats have never really asked hard questions of these judicial appointments that coming out of the Federalist pipeline, particularly Alito, Samuel Alito. And I remember at the time of this Alito's hearings, I remember talking with Cass Sunstein, who ended up having an important job in the Obama administration, and he was buying into the idea that this guy was a nice guy, which is what is exactly what Kavanaugh's saying. You know, I'm a nice guy. I feed the homeless. I coach kids' baseball teams, et cetera. That has nothing to do with what these people stand for. And it seems
Neil Gorsuch liked puppies too, and but he sure didn't like workers when he helped drive a nail in the coffin of public employee unions in this term with the Janus decision, which is going to make it extraordinarily hard for hardworking people who work in the public sector to, you know, fight for fair wages.
Right, but he,
you know, I'm sure they're all nice people, but that has nothing to do with how they rule. They're not nice to us in a as an aggregate. They're not nice to Americans as a collective, even if they may be nice to their neighbor as an individual.
Right, but Neil Gorsuch, he auditioned for the Federalist Society with the frozen trucker case, where a truck driver's rig broke down in the dead of winter, and had he stayed with the rig, he would have frozen to death, and he went to seek help, and Gorsuch ruled against him, and that got the attention of Leonard Leo, and that's how he got on the list. So this is what really concerns me, is this idea that we have this kind of corporatist pipeline going on. And, you know, if you go back to Teddy Kennedy, as opposed to Cass Sunstein that I just mentioned, Teddy Kennedy made it clear that he thought Kavanaugh was a Republican political operative. That's how he described him. So do you think this time the Democrats are going to get real and deal with the reality and the facts that you and I have been discussing?
Well, you know what? We got to make them. This is not something that happens because senators are just feel good in their hearts about it. You know, unfortunately, I'm a bit of a pragmatist on this. And I think, you know, we people who work and live and breathe all of these issues, and that's every American, because every American is going to be affected by dirty air and dirty water and the breakdown of protections for workers and the like. And it means we need to tell them to fight. This is, you know, we've had an imbalance where you have people like Cass Sunstein and today Akhil Amar, who's a professor at Yale Law School, who's supposed to be a progressive, who's praising Brett Kavanaugh because Brett Kavanaugh went to Yale. Well, you know what? This cannot be good enough for all of us because somebody has credentials that somehow seem like they make them qualified. Qualifications mean actually understanding what the law and the Constitution were designed to do, which is to protect us as Americans, to protect our fundamental rights and freedoms, and not to destroy them in service of corporate America and plutocrats. So, you know, I think, you know, we are getting there. I think people, progressives, are starting to realize how important the courts are to their lives. But we have been in a very imbalanced situation where the right pushes really hard and fights, and the left pays attention to other things. Well, the consequences are manifest for us right now. And we went through the cases before, but it's just worth mentioning Bush v. Gore, Citizens United, Shelby County that destroyed the Voting Rights Act, the Janus case, which is really going to be very destructive of public employee unions, and so many more, so many more.
And, of course, Kavanaugh was present at some of those, particularly Bush v. Gore, and he has been involved in most of these great Republican victories, particularly when he was in the Bush White House. So his record as a political operative, going back to when Teddy Kennedy described him that way when he was first up as a nominee to the federal bench, in a 2009 Law Review article that you cite in your article in the New York Times, Caroline Fredrickson, Will Kavanaugh provide cover for Trump? You point out that he basically thinks that the president is above the law, which is highly ironic given his work with Ken Starr in harassing President Clinton, which then, by the way, later, of course, Kavanaugh said, looking back to the late 1990s, for example, the nation certainly would have been better off if President Clinton could have focused on Osama bin Laden without being distracted by Paula Jones' sexual harassment case and its criminal investigations offshoots. He mused, Congress might consider a law exempting a president while in office from criminal prosecution and investigation. So that's where I find this fellow really beyond troubling. Just, you know, the idea that he's been a political operative and now he's suddenly talking about the majesty and neutrality of the law and all original intent and all of that lofty stuff. And, you know, the Democrats did not fight hard or even fight at all, I think, for Merrick Garland. I think perhaps Obama thought Hillary Clinton would be the next president and he didn't have to pull out all the stops. But my God, they should have pulled out all the stops. And I guess it comes down to the question, will they pull out all the stops now?
Well, look, we got a lot on the line. As you mentioned, Brett Kavanaugh has, you know, a lot of chutzpah, to use that word again. It's fine to go after a sitting president and harass him, as he called it, and seek to indict him and depose him when it's a Democratic president. But as soon as he started working for President Bush, all of a sudden, in the face of a president who was accused of allowing torture and illegally spying on Americans, all of a sudden, that kind of activity is beyond the pale. That, you know, of course, a president is all of a sudden above the law. You know, we're now in a situation when there's a president who's desperately looking for a Supreme Court that is going to say he's above the law. And it looks like Justice Kavanaugh, if he's a Justice Kavanaugh, might help deliver that outcome to President Trump. And I think for all of us who care deeply about democracy, fairness, and rule of law in America, this is a deeply, deeply troubling situation.
Well, if they don't shut down the Mueller inquiry, and clearly there's an attempt underway in collusion between the White House and Devin Nunes and the Tea Party Congress people who were trying to put Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, in the impossible position of handing over highly secret work product involving confidential sources whose exposure could lead to their death. This is what they're trying to force Rosenstein to do. He can't do it. And in refusing to turn over this fishing expedition to these Nunes types, who will then immediately turn it over to Fox News, they are probably going to try and impeach him, and then Trump might well be able to say, well, you know, I can't, we've got to get rid of Rosenstein because he's being impeached by the House. I think on that alone, it's pretty clear that Kavanaugh doesn't have a problem with the president. He has absolute authority over the Justice Department, as Kavanaugh has made clear. But the point that you make in your article and you just made, Caroline, is really the key, isn't it, that Kavanaugh is likely to be hearing cases, if Mueller is able to proceed, whether the president can be subpoenaed, whether he can have to testify before a grand jury, whether he can pardon himself, or whether he can pardon those that are under prosecution. All of these are key questions, and my sense is that given the history of Trump having leaned on Comey for loyalty, which Comey was deeply offended by and testified about, it seems very likely to me that Trump has done that with all of these, because he kind of, you know, has this sort of mafia boss kind of swagger about him. He's hung out with gangsters throughout his business life, and he has this obsession with loyalty. So is it possible that this highly ambitious Republican operative, Brett Kavanaugh, was one of the most willing of these four that were interviewed to basically say, yeah, I'll be loyal to you. You know, I'll do your bidding. I know there's no evidence for it, but it's just a deep suspicion on my part.
Here's the thing.
I think what you've identified is certainly a proclivity or an interest by Brett Kavanaugh in supporting the president's interest here. I mean, his Law Review article put it out there that his belief that he thinks the president should be immune from this kind of legal procedure while he's president. And I think there are a lot of back channels between Justice Kennedy and the White House about what kind of person would succeed him. He made it clear who he was favoring. Justice Kennedy's son, who worked at Deutsche Bank and was instrumental in helping Donald Trump get what I believe was $1 billion in loans. So the whole thing looks pretty, you know, how should we say, stinky. looks like a really questionable arrangement in getting a loyal justice, and really, you know, puts to the test the idea that we have an independent judiciary. And again, I think these are things that really have to be examined deeply by the Senate. This line of questions about whether Brett Kavanaugh is going to be independent, whether if a question like this comes before the court, he'll recuse himself. I mean, there are rules of judicial ethics about recusal being required when a judge might have predetermined the outcome of a case. And, you know, that could be the situation here. So senators need to probe and need to get answers before they vote to move Judge Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court.
Well, Caroline Fredrickson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, well, you're absolutely welcome. It's a real pleasure to be on the show.
Well, thank you, Caroline. And again, I've been speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, who's the president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director of NARAL Pro-Choice America. And she is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. And she has an article at the New York Times, Will Kavanaugh Provide Cover for Trump? We can take a restation break. We're back looking into Judge Kavanaugh's dissent opposing net neutrality in favor of corporate First Amendment rights.
Because, after all, he's just a man. Something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gigi Sohn, who has served as counselor to former FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, was co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, and is now a distinguished fellow at Georgetown Law's Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gigi Sohn.
Great to be here.
Well, thank you, Gigi. And you're quoted in an article at Wired magazine, Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court could spell trouble for tech. But let's just start with the fact that in May of 2017, Kavanaugh argued that net neutrality violates Internet service providers' First Amendment rights in a dissent to the D.C. Circuit Court decision regarding the FCC's 2015 order upholding net neutrality. So you were probably right in the midst of all that. So give us your bird's eye view of what happened there.
Well, look, you know, I'm not surprised that a conservative judge would be against net neutrality, but what is shocking and quite honestly radical are the rationales that Judge Kavanaugh gave for not supporting what we did in 2015. First and foremost, and this is not only a threat to net neutrality, it's a threat to any and all oversight over networks of any kind, be they broadcast networks or cable systems or internet service providers. he said that the Internet service providers had First Amendment rights that are absolute, that trumps the public's right to an open Internet, and that trumps the government's right to demand public interest benefits from companies that use public rights of way. And that really is a very fringe position. You know, this was the third time net neutrality was argued in front of the court. And it was also the third time that somebody tried to make a First Amendment argument that Internet service providers had these, you know, First Amendment rights that trumped the public's rights. But this was the first time a judge actually bit on that argument and built his dissent around it. So the fact that he's being elevated to the highest court, you know, he still may be on the fringe there, but it automatically becomes more mainstream than it would have if he were not to be on the court.
Well, Justice Kagan recently, in these recent decisions that came down from the Supreme Court, the union-busting decision Janus and the other decision in California upholding the rights of these deceptive practices of the so-called family planning clinics that are object to abortion, those rulings were also based upon the First Amendment, that this fellow Janus's First Amendment was so important that now public service unions are basically going to be crippled and the Democratic Party is going to be defunded. So it's extraordinary. I think, what did you make of Justice Kagan's comment that these conservatives on the Supreme Court are weaponizing the First Amendment, and now they've got somebody, Brett Kavanaugh, who might join the court, who's already made that argument in terms of net neutrality?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think this is a logical outcome of a case like Citizens United. You know, companies, corporations are people, my friend. And I think that's exactly, this is a very corporatist Supreme Court from John Roberts on down, and Kavanaugh fits that bill beautifully. You know, but whatever you think about, you know, the union case and the other cases, to say that media and telecommunications companies have some sort of absolute right to speak and cannot be regulated in any way, shape, or form is truly radical and would overturn like 85 years of precedent. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me. It's right along the lines of a Supreme Court that believes that corporations have speech equal to individuals. But it's extraordinarily scary for those of us who believe that, you know, these telecommunications and media companies ought to be serving the public.
Well, they used to talk about the FCC as the stewards of the public's ownership of the airwaves.
Yeah, that's right, and that's what the Communications Act is all about. I mean, taken to its logical extreme, you know, Kavanaugh's position on, you know, Internet service providers of the First Amendment could invalidate the entire Communications Act of 1934 and allow companies like AT&T and Comcast and Sinclair and, you know, and Charter to completely run amok and control, quote-unquote, their pipes any way they want. And I think that's just awful for our free speech and awful for democracy.
And again, I'm speaking with Gigi Sohn, who served as counselor to former FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler and was co-founder and president of Public Knowledge and is now a distinguished fellow at Georgetown Law's Institute for Technology, Law and Policy. So how do you think this will play out in these very contentious hearings that we're going to be witnessing as Kavanaugh goes through these confirmation hearings before the U.S. Senate? And it looks as if the Democrats, who haven't really been too vigorous in their opposition, going back to Roberts, Alito, even Gorsuch, and even in defending or not really defending Merrick Garland, who was just so conspicuously treated with such unbelievable
contempt,
I guess it was, by yeah. Mitch McConnell, who's now saying, oh, we've got to be fair to Kavanaugh. You know, obviously the Democrats didn't pull out all the stops then because they thought maybe Hillary Clinton would be elected and it wouldn't be a problem. Well, that was obviously a mistake. Do you think this is going to be a tough fight? Do you think the Democrats are going to pull out all the stops?
I think they have to. And I think I think that the red state Democrats need to stop reading all the news articles from the New York Times on down about how this is going to be a difficult vote for them. What I don't see in any of those articles is any recollection that not even holding a hearing for Merrick Garland for 8 months resulted in absolutely no political peril for Republicans, whether they were in blue states or red states. You know, this is, if the Democrats don't stick together now, I don't know what the future holds for them. You know, Gorsuch is worse than Scalia, and this guy Kavanaugh is going to be pretty darn close, if not even worse than that. So if there was ever a time for the Democrats to stick together and try to get a couple of Republicans on their side, now is the time. And, you know, it's very unclear, you know, where – it's pretty clear where Kavanaugh is going to stand on net neutrality and other oversight of the telecommunications and media industry. What seems less clear is where he's going to be on some of the social issues, like abortion, like gay rights, and what have you. And, you know, while I think, you know, the Democrats care deeply about net neutrality and this will be one of their talking points, what is going to sway some of the Republicans who are gettable, like Susan Collins from Maine, like Lisa Murkowski, are going to be more of the social issues and particularly the future of Roe versus Wade.
Well, he's already made it clear in his dissent in a case involving a teenage immigrant on the southern border who was pregnant, who wanted an abortion, and he tried to stop that. So I think that's a pretty clear harbinger of where he stands on Roe v. Wade.
Well, he did say, though, in 2006 when he was, you know, first appointed to the D.C. Circuit that, you know, he thought that Roe was solid precedent. So they'll, you know, the thing about Kavanaugh that I think is good for those opposing him is that he has a very, very, very long paper trail. And there's a lot of bad stuff in that paper trail, not the least of which is his skepticism over whether a president can be indicted for his crimes. So, and this is one of the reasons that I think, you know, some of the conservatives wanted and others wanted the president to steer away from Kavanaugh. Because there's going to be thousands and thousands of pages of decisions, and he's been around in Washington for a really long time, and there's going to be a lot of stuff to dislike in his record, and, you know, hopefully that will give the Democrats enough fodder. They only really need one more person to come with them because it's unlikely Senator McCain will come back to vote. So they just need one. So they really need to take their time, and they need to stick together. That's what's really critical. We can't have any defections when it comes to the future of civil rights, free speech rights, human rights for really the next generation or even two. I mean, this is for all the Marvels people.
Well, could that one extra Republican be Rand Paul, based upon our conversation vis-a-vis being so less interested in the public's rights and more interested in corporate rights? I don't know where libertarians come down on that.
Well, it could be because Kavanaugh has also sided with the National Security Agency, right, the NSA,
right,
when it's come to the ability of engaging in warrantless searches. And that's something that, you know, Rand Paul does oppose. So, yeah, I mean, that's an entirely possible. He could be one of the dissenters. John Kennedy from Louisiana has been a senator who's been willing to buck the party. So it doesn't just come down to Collins and Murkowski. I think there's at least four or so senators who could be convincible.
But the Democrats are they're the ones that we have to worry about. Manchin and
Heitkamp
and
Tester,
and also the guy in Indiana, right?
Joe Donnelly.
And
again, my pitch to them, if I could have a meeting with them, would be, you know, just remember what happened a couple years ago. Everybody was saying that, you know, not even giving Merrick Garland a hearing was going to have bad consequences for Republicans, particularly in blue states, and absolutely nothing happened to prove that point. and Republicans suffered not one iota politically from putting off a well-qualified and, frankly, moderate and, you know, universally liked judge, keeping him off the court. So that would be my argument, is it's like, number one, you've got to stand for something, even if it means you might lose your seat. Number two, I'm not so, and more importantly, I'm dubious you'd lose your seat over, you know, voting against this guy.
Well, we don't really know what went on in these auditions. We certainly know that in the actual confirmation hearings, many of these key questions that we're discussing, which is, are you or are you not a corporatist, those questions are never asked. But what I am very suspicious about is that we know that Donald Trump, because of Comey's testimony, really leaned on Comey to be loyal, to make a loyalty oath. And I'm not unconvinced. In fact, I'm very suspicious that during these auditions, Trump basically was leaning on these justices to assure him that they'd be in his corner, because his case, Mueller's investigation, might well end up with the Supreme Court on various issues involving the ability to pardon himself, to pardon others, and whether or not he can be subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury. These questions are likely to arise. So we hear that the meeting with Amy Barrett didn't go well, and I wonder why. But we also hear that the meeting with Kavanaugh went incredibly well. So knowing who Trump is, that's my suspicion, that there might well have been this guy, Teddy Kennedy, described Kavanaugh as a Republican political operative. So we don't know how craven he is, do we?
No, I'm not sure Trump really needs, you know, I think Kavanaugh's record kind of speaks for itself about whether he'd be willing to, you know, give Trump a pass even if he is indicted. I mean, he's basically said so much. What I worry more about is, you know, there are reports, and I'm not quite sure they're completely confirmed yet, about whether, you know, the White House or Trump himself kind of cut some sort of deal with Anthony Kennedy in order to get him to resign. You know, sort of promised him that, you know, that his former clerks would be in the running or possibly even get this position. And I also understand a former Kennedy clerk got a high-level position in the executive branch. I mean, if those allegations are true, and I don't want to say they are true because I think they are still at the rumor stage, that to me is, you know, the fact that a Supreme Court seat would essentially be for sale, I think is extremely damning and needs to be investigated thoroughly.
Well, we know that Justice Anthony Kennedy's son is a very close friend of Donald Trump Jr., and that he was the Trump Organization's point man at Deutsche Bank, which loaned Trump over $1 billion and kept him in business after he'd taken down a whole bunch of Wall Street banks and was blackballed and had to turn to Russia for finance. And without Deutsche Bank, Trump would have gone under and be a distant memory. So that trail has already been exposed, and I imagine people are looking at that, are they not?
Yeah, I think they're looking at that. I think there are other trails that may be explored. Like I said, I mean, there are some, you know, I've been hearing various reports, still unconfirmed, that, you know, Kennedy felt comfortable resigning because of promises made about who would replace him. And I think that needs to be fully, you know, investigated and fully vetted, because that's extraordinarily troubling. You know, I heard on NPR the other day an interview with Stephen Breyer in Aspen, and, you know, somebody asked Breyer what he thought about, you know, what happened to Garland, and he would say absolutely nothing. And it is the practice of Supreme Court justices to keep completely out of the politics of their successor. So if indeed these reports are true, I think it's very, very troubling, and, you know, I think all these angles need to be explored before Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Gigi, so let's turn back to the Wired magazine article, Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court could spell trouble for tech. Tech, of course, the Silicon Valley is not a monolith in terms of its political outlook, although
right.
it's often thought of as being largely liberal. But you do have people like Peter Thiel, who's very close to Trump. And you've got these questions now about American tech companies selling surveillance equipment to China, particularly facial recognition and other things that can be used to oppress and control people. There are big questions there. So how do you see the tech world looking at Kavanaugh and his future rulings?
Well, look, to the extent that big tech companies are concerned about, you know, the strengthening of you know, antitrust policy or antitrust enforcement or competition policy enforcement, I think they have nothing to worry about when it comes to Judge Kavanaugh. Yeah, I'm not sure that that title really kind of reflected what the concerns are here. Okay, I think, you know, to the extent that companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, I think they have a friend in Judge Kavanaugh, who, as I said before, is, you know, favors big corporations and does actually have a record in a case called FTC versus Whole Foods in, you know, in basically, he basically said, you know, mergers are good things. You know, what's wrong with a merger? So I think in that regard, they have nothing to worry about. Obviously, he doesn't seem to have a strong sense of privacy rights either, or at least rights with regards to surveillance. That's another place where Silicon Valley has done some stuff that the public interest community isn't crazy about. So I'm not, you know, to the extent that some in the tech community are supportive of net neutrality, and to the extent that, you know, some, like, for example, Apple and others have believed that the, you know, the government has gone too far in surveilling its citizens, then that's something tech isn't going to like. But to the extent that we're talking about some of their business practices and their tendencies to merge and buy other companies, I think they've got very little to worry about if Brett Kavanaugh cedes to the Supreme Court.
Well, Gigi Sohn, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you, Ian.
Thank you, Gigi. And again, I've been speaking with Gigi Sohn, who served as counselor to former FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, was co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, and is now a distinguished fellow at Georgetown Law's Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the religious rights opposition to Kavanaugh and what strategy the Democrats could pursue to make sure the Democratic senators who voted to confirm Gorsuch, Heitkamp, Manchin, and Donnelly will oppose Kavanaugh's appointment.
Not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth. And for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sarah Posner, an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. She's the author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Value Voters. And she has an article at The Nation, Will Brett Kavanaugh Pass the Religious Rights New Litmus Test? Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Posner.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And what I find extraordinary is at this moment, the Republicans, the party of family values, have no problem with their hero, President Trump, ripping children from the arms of their parents on the southern borders. The majority of Americans are against it, but the majority of Republicans are not bothered by it. So where is this religious rights litmus test now in terms of family values and all of the things that they stand for, which their leader, who is immensely popular with Republicans, Donald Trump, is hardly an exemplar of family values, of religious values. He's a, twice divorced libertine, and we won't even get into his possible criminal activity and even the possibility that he's a traitor. So where is this litmus test now, and how does it relate to Brett Kavanaugh?
So the religious right has long wanted a Supreme Court justice who would overturn Roe versus Wade. Trump promised them that during the campaign, but he also promised that he would nominate judges who were protective of what the religious right calls religious freedom. That might not be the religious freedom that other people think of when they think of what the Free Exercise Clause means or what religious freedom means. To the religious right, religious freedom means the ability to be exempt from laws or regulations that they say infringe on their conservative Christian beliefs, that, you know, against same-sex marriage, against abortion, against contraception. So this was a key thing that they were looking for in a judicial nominee, and they were really hoping that Trump would nominate Amy Coney Barrett, who he had previously nominated and got confirmed to the Seventh Circuit, who is just an exemplar of pretty much everything the religious right is looking for in a Supreme Court justice. The fact that he chose Kavanaugh was a little bit of a, I wouldn't call it a snub, but he did not really live up to their expectations by nominating Kavanaugh. That doesn't mean that Kavanaugh isn't extremely conservative and likely quite reliable on all of the issues that they're concerned about, but because he hasn't made that sort of the centerpiece of his legal career, he hasn't seen that many cases on the issue, largely because serving in the D.C. circuit, you don't really see that many culture war issues. So they were a little bit more tepid about the Kavanaugh nomination than they would have been, say, if Trump had nominated Coney Barrett. And one religious right group even came out and said, we should oppose Kavanaugh. I think that in the end, they're going to get behind him, but I think that they're a little bit less enthusiastic about it than they would have been with another nominee.
We know that Amy Barrett was championed by Vice President Pence and by Trump's closest informal advisor, Sean Hannity of Fox News, and the fact that he didn't listen to them is a bit surprising. But my understanding is that the meeting that Trump had with Amy Barrett did not go well, whereas the meeting with Kavanaugh went very well. And I have a suspicion that the reason the meeting went well with Kavanaugh was that Trump might well have asked Kavanaugh the same question that he asked James Comey. Are you loyal to me? I want somebody that's loyal to me. And that is in the context of the real possibility that this next Supreme Court justice will be sitting on a case involving the president himself as to whether he can be indicted, whether he can be subpoenaed before a grand jury, whether he can pardon himself, or whether he can pardon his lieutenants that are involved in criminal activity.
Well, I'm not going to speculate about what happened in the meetings between Trump and Kavanaugh and Trump and Coney Barrett. I did read the coverage that he did not click with her and that she did not do well in her interview. I'm not sure that that has anything to do with, and I don't even know if he asked for any kind of loyalty pledge from any of the nominees. I think that it probably has more to do with the fact, something that you were talking about earlier just a couple minutes ago, that Trump is not a particularly religious person. I think that Coney Barrett is an extremely religious person and very has grown up in a sort of insular environment and is, let's just say, a lot more straight-laced than Trump is. I think that possibly the getting along better with Kavanaugh might have just something to do with the way Trump is around men versus the way he is around women. You know, I think that perhaps she might have not, you know, they might not have clicked because they don't really
right.
come from the same place on these
right.
kind of, you know, religious values.
Right. She's not a porn star or a playmate.
Right.
No, I get
right.
it.
And far from it. Right.
right.
So, but I think the thing to look at with regard to Kavanaugh and whether he would really defend the Constitution in the face of having a case before him where, you know, say, a Trump challenge to a possible subpoena from Mueller or a Trump challenge to an indictment from Mueller, hypothetically. I think that what we need to look at is his record, which is pretty lengthy on the extent of, you know, executive power and whether whether sitting presidents can be subpoenaed or indicted. He's changed his mind about that over the course of his legal career. You know, he thought during the Clinton era that sitting presidents could be indicted, but then later sort of scaled that back when he was during the Bush era. So I think that requires a lot of scrutiny and requires a lot of scrutiny by the Senate Judiciary Committee during his confirmation hearings. And so, I mean, but barring any evidence that Trump out and out asked him for anything, I think that even without that, there's plenty to mine in Kavanaugh's record on that topic.
Well, our previous guest, Gigi Sohn, was talking about the possibility that something went on with Anthony Kennedy. Promises were made, negotiations were conducted between Kennedy and the White House and via his son, Justin, who's close to Donald Trump Jr. And Justin was the point person at Deutsche Bank that was responsible for lending about $1 billion to Trump that kept him going.
Kennedy's son's position in Deutsche Bank, I think we all know that. And we also know now from reporting that potentially, it's not clear what the timing was that Trump and Kennedy met and possibly discussed Kennedy's successor. But I think that, like, there's no evidence that there was a quid pro quo between them. The discussion might have happened about who his successor should be or what his recommendation for that might have happened after Kennedy had already announced his decision to retire. So I don't think it serves anybody to get into the realm of speculation about the possibility of a quid pro quo. I know that given all of the terrible and corrupt things Trump has done in plain sight, that it doesn't stretch the imagination to think that something like that could have happened, but without evidence of it, I'm really reluctant to go there. I do think that, like I said before, that it requires the scrutiny of the Senate Judiciary Committee to look into all of this, but I don't want to go down the path of speculating.
So how do you think then the Democrats should proceed in this hearing, in the sense that they have to pull out all the stops? They didn't really fight for Merrick Garland. They probably thought that Hillary Clinton was a shoo-in. But this time around, the indications are that they are going to fight. And what do you do about those wavering Democrats? Because all you have to do is peel off one or two Republicans and perhaps even, Rand Paul, because Kavanaugh is quite pro-government in terms of their ability to surveil American citizens, which is something that we know Rand Paul's opposed to. What can be done, do you think, to stop those wavering Democrats, Manchin, Connolly, Heitkamp, and Tester?
Well, I suspect that the questions around Kavanaugh's views on the Mueller probe, whether he thinks that it has, like some Republicans have claimed, exceeded its time length or its authority or its mandate, whether he thinks that, it should be ended, whether he thinks that a sitting president can be indicted or subpoenaed. I think those are areas where this is not about ideology, as in, like, is Kavanaugh for or against abortion, for example. But these go kind of to the heart of our democracy and the heart of the separation of powers and the ability of the judicial branch to do its job without political influence. So, and also about law enforcement being able to do its job without political influence. So I think that those are fruitful areas of inquiry. And I think that if Kavanaugh doesn't have good explanations for why his legal thinking on these matters changed or evolved over the years, and if he doesn't have good answers on defending the Mueller probe from political interference, I think that is something that could I mean, I think that setting aside the strategy of it, I think that they have an obligation to the Republic to pursue that line of questioning with him. But I think those are things that the Democrats could hold up as, you know, this, you know, we're defending the Constitution, we're defending the separation of powers, we're defending democracy by asking these questions. These are not about ideology, they're not about litmus tests for or against abortion or what have you. These are the crucial questions facing our democracy right now. And so it would be completely, you know, malpractice of them to not pursue that line of questioning with Kavanaugh, regardless of whether it sways Joe Manchin or Heidi Heitkamp or whatever. I mean, they have an absolute obligation to do that, given all of the circumstances that we just talked about and Kavanaugh's career history and his writing history.
Well, just in closing, though, don't you think that the argument that I think Democrats should make, given who their constituency is, which is middle class and working Americans, although in many people argue that they've kind of abandoned this constituency and gone corporate. But the lines are pretty clearly drawn between corporatists, and this guy is an even greater corporatist than Robert Alito and Gorsuch, all of whom have been put on the court by the Federalist, who clearly talk about all this lofty stuff. At the end of the day, they put on corporatists who expand corporate power at the expense of the worker and the consumer. And just before this whole thing with Kennedy happened, the Supreme Court ruled in Ohio versus American Express in favor of American Express, making it easy for these big companies to pressure workers, suppliers, and customers. So we're all getting screwed as consumers and as workers as more and more power is given to corporate America. And that is a question that's never asked. So why not make that the centerpiece of your argument?
Well, I mean, I don't see why all of these things cannot be the subject of confirmation hearings. I mean, you know, I think that the question of how beholden or dedicated a Supreme Court nominee is to corporate versus individual or little guy or Main Street interests is crucial line of questioning. You're right. But I do think that these questions around the health or the ability of the Mueller probe to continue to its conclusion and for wrongdoers to be held accountable for their wrongdoing is, you know, just absolutely essential for them to drill down into during the confirmation hearings. I can't imagine that is not something that is going to be at the top of the list.
Well, Sarah Posner, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, who's an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. She's the author of God's Prophets, that's Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Value Voters. And she has an article of The Nation, Will Brett Kavanaugh Pass the Religious Right's New Litmus Test? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Martz. I'd like to thank producer Grant Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.